So today we're going to start the next section of the course talking about depolarizing ion channels. Everything on our lecture agenda up till the next exam will be things that have to do with ion channels. First, we're going to go through voltage-gated channels, well, primarily voltage-gated channels. We'll talk about a couple that are non-gated real quickly. And then we will look at ligand-gated ion channels, ones that are gated by different neurotransmitters or various drugs in specific ways. Then the third section of the course, again, we'll be back to metabotropic mechanisms, things that we learned for the first exam, all of the different G-protein-related things, all of the second messenger cascades, all of that will, again, become very relevant. And then the fourth part of the course, we'll cover everything else in neuropharmacology that we have room and time to fit in, assuming we don't have any more week or two long vacations unexpectedly. Okay. All right. So on this slide, nothing really should be unfamiliar to you, but just as a way of refreshing, let's look at a few different concepts. When we're measuring membrane potential, and we can tell in lots of different ways on different diagrams, and it's good to get used to looking at the scales and the axes. There are different ways that those will be conveyed on different diagrams. On this one, the y-axis clearly shows membrane potential in millivolts, so we're looking at voltage responses of a cell membrane. And a typical neuron will have a resting potential somewhere around minus 70 millivolts, plus or minus 4 or 5 millivolts. That's the resting potential. And if we begin to excite that cell in some manner, either electrically or with neurotransmitters or with drugs, we can begin a process of depolarization, moving it away from that resting potential. And eventually we will hit some threshold potential, which will then massively activate large numbers of voltage-dependent channels. In neurons, that's primarily sodium channels. And we'll get a massive depolarization of the membrane that we call the positive phase or the rising phase of the action potential. The action potential doesn't go up infinitely. It has some upper boundary. And then it begins to fall back to the resting potential. And that fall, again, is not a passive process. It's an active process driven by ion channels again. You think it's driven by sodium channels? It's driven by potassium channels largely. Okay, we'll talk about their role. Very often, the membrane potential will fall back down below the resting potential for a period after firing of an action potential. And that we call an after hyperpolarization. The hyperpolarization that occurs after the action potential and after hyperpolarization. And then with some time course, it may then return back to the resting potential. Another term we'll often use to describe these action potentials would be spikes. Spike firing events, action potential firing events. And when they come in a cluster like that, we would call that a burst of action potentials or burst firing of the neuron. So those should all be familiar terms to everyone. Okay. Now when we talk about the movement of ions across the cell membrane, one important consideration is the concentration of those ions and where they tend to be local, where they tend to be high, and where they tend to be low in concentration. Your textbook has got all of this information, the Netzler book, concentrations of these various ions. And hopefully in cellular neuroscience, you work through the Nernst equation. Those of you who have had neurophysiology have done some computational related problems on that as well. I'm not interested in you looking at the math of it right now, but looking at it conceptually. If you look, for instance, at sodium ions, there's about a tenfold ratio, tenfold higher concentration of sodium outside the membrane to inside the cell membrane. Similar sort of ratio for many of the other ions. Chloride, about that same range. Potassium, about double that, but still in the same ballpark. But look at the ratio for calcium ions. Not a 10 or 20-fold ratio, but a 10,000-fold ratio. As a consequence, there's a very large concentration gradient down which calcium ions can move. A great deal of concentration pressure, if you will, to push ions in a particular direction. And these ions do not pass freely through the lipid bilayer. They can only move through ion channels, through openings that are made in the membrane bilayer through these channels. So most of the events that we think of generating these large electrical potentials are generated by these relatively small concentration gradients for sodium ions, slightly larger concentration gradients for potassium ions. But look at the potential for what calcium ions could do. If calcium channels were just as freely unregulated as these other types of channels. Now, we've already talked a lot about calcium. We're going to talk a lot more today about calcium channels. But we can't forget the other types of channels as well. Before we get into channels for specific ions, let's look at one category, what we call ionophores, or leak channels. These channels are not regulated in the same fashion as the other ion channels we'll be talking about. They're not gated by voltage. They're not gated by neurotransmitters. They're not gated by phosphorylation or any of the other types of events that can affect ion channels. These are typically thought of as toxins because they're produced by organisms and they're soluble, so that they can incorporate themselves into the membranes of cells. And when they do that, then they make the membranes of these cells leaky. They allow ions to pass through. Ones that are very commonly encountered, and you'll see them a lot in the research literature, but they're also used as antifungals and antibiotics, are these that are in color: gramicidin, nystatin, and amphotericin. All of them form channels that are selective for monovalent cations. Monovalent cations. What does that phrase mean? Monovalent. Charge of plus one. Cation. It's a positive charge, not a negative charge. Anion would be a negative charge. So what ions do we typically look at for neurons that are monovalent cations? Sodium and potassium ions. Okay. Sodium ions would tend to rush into the cell membrane through these. Potassium ions would tend to move out from the inside of the cell across the cell membrane. If there's twice the concentration gradient for potassium that there is for sodium, what would the possible effect be on the cell membrane? Hyperpolarize it or depolarize it? It would hyperpolarize the membrane. It would be moving more positive charges out of the inside of the cell than positive charges into the inside of the cell. So these would be very inhibitory, typically, in terms of the functional activity of neurons. Could essentially shut them down, make their membrane potentials so negative that they couldn't fire action potentials. Okay, if you're releasing this and say you're a marine organism, it makes it very convenient because whatever you release it near suddenly stops swimming away from you. Makes it much easier to catch them and eat them. So these are ionophores or leak channels. Obviously, there's a large number of them. This is not an all-inclusive table. There's lots more than this. But if you know those three, gramicidin, nystatin, and amphotericin, that's more than enough for general use in the neurosciences. Okay. We've also talked about other ways to change membrane potential. And I decided to put this slide in here just to remind you that there are ATPases or pumps that can change membrane potentials. One that's very commonly found in the cell membrane is called sodium-potassium ATPase. So it's an enzyme that uses what as its substrate? ATP. What does it produce as its product? ADP. What does it have as its cofactors? Sodium and potassium ions. Okay. And in fact, sodium-potassium ATPases are a little bit unique in that they have an unequal exchange rate. For every 3 sodium ions that are pumped out of the cell, 2 potassium ions are pumped in. What does that do to the membrane potential as this pump continues to run? Pardon? It hyperpolarizes the cell, makes it more negative, because more positive charges are leaving than are coming in. We also have calcium ATPases. They're found in the endoplasmic reticulum, but they're also found in the cell membrane. Again, they have the same substrate, same product, but a different cofactor, calcium ions. 1 calcium ion per ATP used up. If they're in the cell membrane and they're pumping calcium out of the cytosol into the extracellular space, what would they do to the membrane potential? These are positively charged ions again with a +2 charge. It would again be hyperpolarizing the membrane potential. So these pumps play an important role in establishing that resting potential of the membrane and maintaining that resting potential. Not surprisingly, there are toxins that various organisms have devised to disrupt the function of these pumps. We could call them pump toxins or ATPase toxins. How many of you again have clinical intents in the future? You want to go to medical school or dental school? It'd be very important for you to know some of these sorts of drugs. Digitalis. And how do you think this one's pronounced? Pretend like that's a W. Wabane. Doesn't look like it would be a W. Looks like an OU. Must be the Oklahoma spelling of Wabane. Wabane. These two are widely used drugs, particularly digitalis, in clinical practice. They block sodium-potassium ATPases. Digitalis comes from plants, at least in the natural form, but these days we get it as a synthetic as well. The one I didn't put on the list, but we frequently see examples of it in Texas, exuded from the skins of toads. Another good reason why you shouldn't lick toads is one called bufodienolidase. Also blocks sodium-potassium ATPases. The proper dose, these can slow down your heart rate. The wrong dose, they could stop your heart. And then we already talked about this one. Anybody remember Thapsigargin?
Yes.
Okay, and it blocks calcium ATPases. Again, originally it was plant-derived, but these days we get it in synthetic form as well. One of these substances, wabane, can be an exogenous substance, but it is also found endogenously. It's produced in fairly large quantities in the adrenals, the adrenal cortex, the outer batch of cells in the adrenal. But it's also found endogenously produced by glial cells in the central nervous system. Glial cells are interested in regulating calcium ATPases, not only in the cell membrane, but also in the endoplasmic reticulum of neurons, and release substances to help do so. Lots and lots of clues from the biology that calcium can have both good effects in cells and also very detrimental effects. It is very tightly regulated. So Waban can be an endogenous substance. So that one, if you had a true false question on that, either answer would be correct. Is this an endogenous substance? Could be either way. All right, most of you are familiar with the concept of depolarizing channels. They open and allow passage of ions and result in a change in the membrane potential that makes it less negative, moves it away from that minus 70, minus 68 millivolt resting potential up in the direction of zero or even an overshooting potential, something in the very positive direction. And again, it depends on the concentration gradient for these ions, how much ion is going to move across those channels. Also depends on how long this ion channel is open, how many of those ion channels are present. We have two primary types of depolarizing channels, sodium channels and calcium channels. Sodium and calcium. You hardly ever see this abbreviation, voltage-dependent sodium channels. You'll quite often see this abbreviation, voltage-dependent calcium channels. Once upon a time, we didn't think there was anything but voltage-dependent sodium channels. We know we're wrong, but the abbreviation still doesn't get used much. Don't know why. When we look at these ion channels, a couple of important physical characteristics of them are their selectivity and their gating properties. Selectivity has to do with what type of ion passes through the channel. That has to do with physical characteristics of the ion channel protein, typically near the entry point of that ion channel. Different types of charges that are present on the amino acids making up that portion of the molecule can determine how large an ion could fit through there or what type of charge that ion could have. So different types of channel proteins will have different selectivity. Another important characteristic is the gating. What causes them to go from a closed state where no ions can move through them to an open state where ions can move through very rapidly? And in fact, there's evidence for three different types of gating mechanisms that are shown over here on the right. Once upon a time, we thought this was probably the most probable model, that there would be what we would call a regional conformational change, change in one specific portion of the protein structure, maybe movement of a couple of amino acids based on charge applied to the membrane, voltage of the membrane. And that movement of a small portion of its structure would open or close the channel. Some models still allow for that type of a structure. It appears that it's fairly rare to have this type of a gating mechanism, a general conformational change, where the entire protein changes its shape. And the more we know about ion channels, the best evidence we have is that most utilize mechanisms like this. The majority of the protein structure is very rigid, and small portions of it are very mobile. In fact, they tend to be located on the intracellular side of the protein structure and essentially act like something like a cork. They can either plug the channel or leave it open. Or as this artist tried to show it, like the plug in a bathtub attached to a chain. Many of you have probably never seen a bathtub plug of that sort, particularly if you only take showers. That would be called something along the lines of a blocking particle or a blocking gate. Everybody clear on the difference between open and closed state of a channel? And to account for everything that ion channels do, we need more than just an open and closed state. We need an additional state that we call an inactive state. In the closed state, we essentially have two mechanisms that are operative. One is the activation gate, the mechanism that allows the ion channel to open up so that ions can flow through. And when that happens, when this activation gate is open, then we get current flow. The other is this blocking particle that when it comes in and acts as a cork, plugging the ion channel. Now the ion channel is still in an open state, but nothing can move through it. And so, hence it's called inactive. So we talk about inactivation of ion channels. The movement from the closed state, when it's ready to go, to the open state typically is very fast. It's measured in nanoseconds or small fractions of a microsecond. The movement from the open state, when ions are flowing through the channel, to the inactive state is highly variable. Depends on the type of ion channel. And we're going to have to pay a lot of attention to that in just a few minutes' time. Going from a period where ions are flowing through to no longer any current flow. And then to move from this inactive state back to the state where it's ready to open again, what we call the closed state, tends to be a slow process. You have to uncork the bottle and at the same time close the gate. So it can be a complex molecular process to do that. In many cases, going from the inactive to the closed state is voltage dependent. And we'll look at that for sodium channels in just a moment. Does this make sense to everybody? Three different states of ion channels. Not just two, but three. The way that we investigate these is using a technique that we call patch clamping. And we put a relatively large diameter electrode, somewhere in the order of about a micron in diameter, on down to maybe a few hundred nanometers in diameter, onto a cell membrane, and suck up a portion of the membrane. If you're lucky enough, you get a single ion channel within the lumen of that electrode tip. And you can do different configurations. You can rip them off from the cell, you can leave them attached to the cell, you can leave them inside out, outside in, and they're not going to go into all those details. In this particular case, we got lucky and got a sodium channel. One sodium channel protein. Everybody familiar with voltage and current? Everybody familiar with Ohm's law? What is Ohm's law? E equals IR. E is the same thing as voltage. For some reason, engineers don't like to use V, even though they use it in all their scales as V. They still like to call it E here for some reason. It goes back to the history of physics a few hundred years ago. You should get used to the fact that in neurophysiology, we look sometimes at voltage, sometimes at current. So you need to pay attention to which type of signal you're looking at. In this case, we're going to look at the membrane potential. We're going to have the membrane potential at a resting potential, a hyperpolarized potential. And at some point in time, we're going to step that to a depolarized potential by applying a particular stimulus to the recording electrode. We're going to depolarize the membrane. When you do that and you're recording from a sodium channel, I'm sitting here not doing anything. This is just a noise in the amplifier, or what we sometimes call thermal noise. You suddenly get a change in the current. You get what we call an inward current flow. So here you have to understand the convention. In neurophysiology, an inward current flow is a downward deflection of the current. Down is inward. So think of it as a cell membrane, things are moving in. Use that convention. This inward current flow comes on for a short period of time, even though we're sustaining the depolarization for a long time. And then it turns itself back off. When it turns off, that's evidence for inactivation of the sodium channels. Inactivation. The cork has gone into the bottle. The activation stimulus was this depolarization, making the membrane potential more positive. That was sufficient to turn the channel on, but not to keep it on forever. Inactivation over a period of time turn the channel back off. For sodium channels, that's typically somewhere on the order of a few hundred microseconds. A few hundred microseconds before inactivation occurs. For some of them, it's much less than that. Tens of microseconds. If we look at those kinds of records repeatedly, so we can't keep stepping the membrane potential from rest up to a depolarized potential. In this case, after about 15 milliseconds, step it back down to the resting potential. We can repeatedly activate the sodium currents, inward sodium currents. They repeatedly inactivate and turn back off. For any given protein, any given ion channel, total amount of current will vary from instance to instance. More sodium ions in the vicinity of this particular channel. Not quite as fully back to the closed state from instance to instance. But on average, it will be close to the same amount of current each time.
But why do we still have a change in membrane potential when it's inactive?
The top trace, because we're doing that with our amplifier. It's not coming from the ion channel itself. Okay.
What's important here is that we brought the membrane potential back down to rest, where we'd only get one of these. Not all of the others, no change.
You could have kept it depolarized forever, and it never would have opened again. What's required for sodium channels to go from that inactive state back to the closed state so that they can open again is that the membrane potential has to repolarize. Here we're doing it with our amplifier. Neurons normally do this with potassium channels, bring the membrane potential back to rest. Otherwise, sodium channels would only fire one action potential, and that would be it. So you would be allowed one thought your entire life, probably in utero, and that would be it. One heartbeat, one muscle twitch. It's probably good that we aren't built that way. So we go from the open state caused by the depolarization to the inactive state, and then when we repolarize the membrane, bring it back down to a negative potential, then the change occurs to go back to the closed state. It requires all those steps. It's a three-step process. Yes?
Can you go over again why on the second paragraph the channel opens later than the first?
That will depend on the experimental circumstances. It could be because it hadn't completely gone back to the closed state. It takes some time. So if you put these depolarizing pulses too close together, you won't be ready to open the channel again. It's the most likely explanation.
And repolarization occurs during the inactive state of the channel?
Pardon?
Repolarization, it occurs when the channel is inactive?
In this experiment. Doesn't have to happen that way. Changes in the membrane potential could happen based on whatever inputs are to the neuron. But for any given sodium channel, it's only got three states. For it to be ready to pass current, it's got to be in the closed state. When it's in the closed state, it can open, but it can't stay open very long. And then once it is in that inactive state, it's got to come back to a negative potential again to get itself ready to open again, to go from inactive back to closed. It's not a two-step process. It's a three-step process. And that took neurophysiologists about 100 years to understand. So if you're not grasping it completely in 2 minutes' time, don't feel too bad. Again, read over that section of your chapters.
So when you have stimulus, the voltage is changing, it's opening.
It can be opened by it, yes.
There's current flow, then it becomes inactive.
And the current stops flowing.
And while it's inactive, that's when it's in the process of closing again.
No, not closing. Closing and removing the inactivation. The two-step, both of those have got to occur.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still waiting for the question, so what does that involve? And the answer to that is we don't know yet. There are several laboratories down at Southwestern that have spent the last 30 years trying to figure that out. They know just a tiny fraction of what we need to know. But we know that inactivation occurs for most every type of channel. Not all of them, though. And we'll look at some that don't seem to go through that inactivation in a moment, too. Sodium channels have all three states. We know that when we look at ion channels, this is the way a protein chemist would like to show a sodium channel. Some repeated subunits inserted in this lipid bilayer. The yellow thing is the cell membrane. Repeated sequence of transmembrane segments, some weird loops, some on the extracellular side, some on the intracellular side, and repeat. Typically,
These depolarizing channels have this structure. It's conserved. Four sets of closely associated transmembrane segments. Each of these sets, there's six subunits. So 24 subunits total to make up that ion channel. Back for sodium channels, and you know this particular part of the protein structure, this little loop here, it's the portion that's responsible for making it voltage dependent. This portion here makes up that quark, the inactivation particle. Very similar structure for calcium channels. Very different structure for certain types of potassium channels. Please don't try to draw that whole diagram straight out of your textbook. Slightly different artist looking at the same thing. This must have been an artist from Ireland. It's like Celtic knots there on the inside. Again, we've identified the portion that serves as the inactivation gate. It's one small part of the structure. Enough to give it these major properties. Four sets of subunits with six transmembrane segments each. So this is the way a protein chemist would look at it. This is the way a neuroscientist would prefer to visualize the same information, looking at it as it would actually be, if we're looking at it at least in cartoon fashion, in the cell membrane. Arranged to form an ion channel. The protein chemist, the function's not really that relevant. For a neuroscientist, the function is pretty much everything. When those four subunits clump together, they form a pore in the center. It can be opened or closed or inactivated. Or, if you're a different type of protein chemist, and you'd like to look at crystallography, you can look at the structure in this way. In this case, you're looking down from above. Or if you're interested in the evolutionary biology of different varieties of sodium channels, you might like to look at their lineage. Notice none of this is in color. You can pretend this isn't in color either. I'm going to try to reproduce that. We know now there's a number of different subvariants of sodium channels. Nine different ones so far identified. Relevant piece of information here, you know this is a sodium channel. Molecular biologists have immediately named it NA for sodium, V for voltage dependent. There's only one main family. So they put the number one and then the nine different subvariants. NaV1 is a voltage-dependent sodium channel. Anyone ever heard of this category of drugs, local anesthetics? Hopefully you haven't ingested any of them today. The prototypical one of these drugs is cocaine. Cocaine. Notice the suffix on cocaine, cane. And the major clinical drugs in this category have that same suffix. Okay. How many of you think you've had this drug when you went to a dentist? You're wrong, but most people still think that.
What is it?
Dentists even tell you that sometimes. That's because people assume they're going to get it. Lidocaine is the most commonly used, but it's fairly long-acting. Novocaine is long-acting, and it has liver toxicity. It's not even regularly used in clinical practice anymore.
These days, the better dentists will use something like bupivacaine. Shorter acting, maybe an hour and a half. In most cases, a dentist can finish whatever they want to do in an hour and a half. 2 hours, tops. Lidocaine, you might still be numb 6 hours later. Novocaine, you might still be numb 12 or 15 hours later. So even though you thought you got Novocaine, you didn't. Yes, sir?
How would you be numb if you use cocaine?
Cocaine? It's actually fairly short-acting. Typically less than 20 minutes or so. And in fact, once upon a time, it had wide clinical application. You could buy it over the counter. It used to be a major ingredient in Coca-Cola. And all sorts of different patent drugs.
Wasn't it a major antidepressant until about
1980? Not really an antidepressant, but it was widely used. Yeah, Freud liked it a lot. That's putting it mildly. Yeah, we had a whole series of drug laws enacted about 1920 up through the 30s that created most of the current regulations we have. Yep. All right, so that's one way to block sodium channels, local anesthetics. There are other ways. This is a drug called tetrodotoxin. It's an organic substance. Comes from these creatures, pufferfish. Any fans of sushi out there? Okay. You probably in the Dallas area can't get fugu sushi. But if you go to Japan and are willing to pay enough, and it's pretty expensive, you can get fugu. Made from the flesh of this fish. It's considered quite a delicacy. Even the muscles of this fish contain low quantities of TTX, tetrodotoxin. Very potent sodium channel blocker. At really low concentrations, you can block essentially all the sodium channels that you possess. You have to go to a really high-end sushi restaurant, because chefs have to be specially trained not to nick the particular gland that secretes tetrodotoxin. Because if they don't remove it properly and nick it, and it dumps out all the TTX onto the fish, then you don't get really tiny amounts, which is what attracts people to it, because it makes your tongue tingle. Your mouth sort of goes numb. Instead, you ingest it, and all muscle movement in your body ends. So you get one last tingle and that's it. Also in Japan, it's no longer allowed that the sushi chef then throw themselves on their ginsu knife. But that once upon a time, that was the custom if they screwed up. Definitely out of the favor for Dallas chefs. If the Dallas chef screws up, they open a new restaurant. So tetrodotoxin is very widely used experimentally, but it's a natural product. It's used as a defensive mechanism by these fish. Some other fish eats one of these. They're not going to eat any other fugu fish. Doesn't do any good for that individual fugu, but for the species, it works really well. So tetrodotoxin is one naturally occurring sodium channel blocker. Another one that's very commonly encountered is another marine organism, one that's called saxitoxin. Saxitoxin. You've ever seen the phenomenon called red tide? It's something that's released by some of those reddish dinoflagellates and results in massive fish kills. Shuts down their nervous system. Saxitoxin. It's Sounds like something that would come from England. Saxons. So you can see there's a lot of different types of sodium channel toxins, just like there was lots of taine-type products. The other one, really, besides saxitoxin and tetrodotoxin, worth learning, is one that's going to violate a rule that I'm going to typically use in class, and that's not to have you learn letter number combinations. QX314. QX314. If you read very much in the neurophysiology literature, you're going to see that one. It's a very expensive sodium channel blocker. TTX is pretty expensive. For a microgram of TTX, it's about $100. Cocaine's much cheaper. QX314 is about 20 times as expensive as tetrodotoxin. So about 2,000 times as expensive as cocaine. But actually, it's cheaper to use in the laboratory. All the rest of these act on the outside of the sodium channel. They bind from the extracellular side. And when they bind, they take the normal sodium current. You tell this is current because what's the scale say? What's that letter there? Pico amps. Current is measured in amps, not volts. Take this nice strong inward current and block much of it. QX314 can do the same thing. Even though it's more expensive to buy, it's cheaper to use. Because you put it in your recording electrode and then it diffuses into the cell. It acts on the intracellular side of the membrane. The inside of the sodium channel. So to use TTX or to use cocaine to block sodium channels, you have to apply it to all the cells in your preparation. If you're doing it in a whole animal, it takes lots. QX314, you need enough to fill one neuron. A very tiny quantity. And it's just as effective. You'd think somebody would give it a name by now. But it's still called QX314.
Why is it so expensive?
It actually can be derived from chili peppers. It's a really complex process to do it. It takes tons of chili peppers to get a usable quantity. Synthesis is pretty complex, too. It's a quinoxylene derivative. And those tend to be pretty hard to synthesize. You can probably make a good pile of money if you can come up with a new synthetic pathway. So obviously there's lots and lots of sodium channel blockers. I don't expect you to learn them all. But there are some that would be a good idea. Exams should be fairly fresh in your mind still. In the future, you might have use for knowing a handful of them. And not just for the exam, but because it'll be useful in your future as well.
So is the mechanism for these and the lipoamine effects the same and they're just differentiated?
They bind to slightly different sites on the sodium channel. But they result in the same thing. They block flow of ions through the channel. Good question, though. We also have a class of drugs called cardiostimulants. Cardiostimulants. They affect the inactivation of sodium currents. They slow the inactivation. So they keep the channel open longer. And they come from lots of different natural sources. Don't expect you to remember any of the particular sources. But clinically relevant drugs are aconitine and veratridine. You can tell these are clinical drugs because they didn't put the word toxin on them. It's only in the last few years that Botox, somebody thought to shorten that up and then it was useful clinically. But aconitine and veratridine All the rest have this toxin in their name. For neurons, they're neurotoxins. They keep sodium channels open a long time. But if your heart's not beating well, you have a lot of, say, loss of heart muscle. You need to still be able to pump enough blood to keep organs like your brain or other parts alive. You need sodium channels to stay open longer. But long term, not a good solution. You're probably on your way out. Okay, so cardiostimulants don't affect the channel directly, they affect that inactivation particle. Delay the rate at which it inactivates the channel. All right, so that's it for sodium. Let's go to the other type of depolarizing ion, calcium. Again, this is a summary of some of the stuff we've talked about before. We've talked about calcium stores. We've talked about the role of calcium binding proteins in their stores. We've talked about the endoplasmic reticulum. We've talked about the fact that mitochondria also have a huge store of calcium. We've talked about calcium release from those stores. The role of IP3 receptors and ranitidine receptors. If you remember the latter one, ranitidine receptors experience what we call calcium-dependent calcium release. Calcium ions could activate them as well. We talked about pumps, ways to get rid of calcium, ATPases or exchangers. Now we're going to concentrate on one of the means to get calcium in, voltage-dependent calcium channels. Now, in a week or two, we'll talk about the other class, NMDA receptors. Remember, there's about a 10,000-fold concentration gradient for calcium ions. Huge concentration gradient. And yet, big changes in the membrane potential are not typically driven by calcium ions, are driven by sodium ions. So there must be some really tight regulation of these mechanisms. Okay. Another thing we've looked at relevant to calcium, it's calcium imaging. Everybody remember when we talked about neurotransmitter release? And we looked at different fluorescent images of an axon terminal at rest and then during the depolarizing event. We looked at calcium concentration in different regions of cells. See it being really high, the red, really low, the darker colors. We typically do that with either just conventional fluorescent microscopy, or these days more commonly, confocal fluorescent microscopy. So we can see down at smaller resolution. We're still limited to the wavelengths of light, though. We can't see as small as structures as you can with electron microscopy. And typically, to see the calcium, we use different fluorescence calcium indicators. These are different molecules that bind calcium ions. And the more calcium that's bound to them, the different wavelengths of light that reflect off of them. So if we put in light at one particular wavelength, say red, and you have a little bit of calcium, you might get a blue light back reflected from these molecules. When you have a lot of calcium, you might get a yellow light reflected back. And gradations in between, different other reflectances. So they're called indicators of the calcium concentration. We have dozens and dozens of calcium indicators available these days. The one that you'll most commonly see is one called Fura. Fura. How many of you have ever looked at calcium imaging techniques? Anybody here work in Dr. Croner's lab? He does that over in internal these days. Probably next year, because he's only had a lab since September. All right, again, this is mostly a summary. We've already talked about these intracellular calcium channels. One class was the IP3 receptors. Everybody remember IP3 receptors? They're found in neurons. And at first we thought they were just a neuron. Now we know they're in muscle cells too. IP3 is an agonist for them. Binds to them, it opens them, activates them. There are other substances too, but the endogenous one is enough to know, IP3. There are drugs that are antagonists for these IP3 receptors. Prevent them from having IP3 bind to them. Competitive antagonists. One that's most widely used is heparin. Heparin. Anyone ever heard of heparin as a drug before? It's not typically used because it's an antagonist of IP3 receptors. Heparin's main clinical effect is to prevent platelet clotting in your bloodstream. This is considered a side effect, the effect on IP3 receptors. And in fact, this drug, and this would be considered a side effect, really high concentrations of caffeine can block IP3 receptors. For reanidine receptors, who's going to become a specialist in reanidine receptors here? So this is more detail than you really need. You actually find it in slightly different forms in different types of cells. Slight different variant in skeletal muscle versus cardiac muscle. Different variant again in neurons. For all of them, small quantities of reanidine is an agonist. Nanomolar concentrations is an agonist. Heparin for reanidine receptors is also an agonist, not an antagonist. And very large quantities of heparin, I'm sorry, not of heparin, of reanidine or of caffeine is an antagonist. Low quantities of reanidine or caffeine is an agonist. Low concentrations. So if people are doing experiments with it, they'll typically use a low concentration of reanidine to turn them on, and a completely different drug to block them. Dantrolene. So if you're going to become a specialist, you need to know a lot more even than on this chart. If not, knowing reanidine and heparin are agonist for reanidine receptors, and heparin is an antagonist for IP3 receptors, you can probably keep track of that pretty readily. And dantrolene is a good antagonist for reanidine receptors. And the other thing, again, we already mentioned it, reanidine receptors exhibit calcium-dependent calcium release. We've got a lot of calcium in the cell cytosol inside the membrane. That can activate reanidine receptors and release even more calcium. So when you see charts like this that look complicated, simplify them down. If you want the complexity, it's there. If you don't want to deal with the complexity, write the simple version down. It's up to you. How much do you want to know? Again, where are these channels found? In the endoplasmic reticulum. The neurons, we call it rough ER. The muscles, you might have rough or smooth ER. Seen pictures like this before? Pretty good guess that this is a voltage-dependent channel of some sort. There's probably a depolarizing channel because it's got four sets of six transmembrane segments each. This is the structure for a voltage-dependent calcium channel. Must have been drawn by an English artist instead of an Irish one. There are two major classes of calcium channels. And they're named, these major classes, by what it takes to activate these channels. One are called LVAs, the other are called HVAs. LVAs are low voltage activated channels. That means they're activated by movements, depolarizations, that are very small. Membrane potentials, maybe 10, 20, 30 millivolts away from the resting potential. So what do you think it would take to turn on a high voltage activated channel? Smaller or low or bigger depolarizations? Large, big. Membrane potential changes up closer to 0 millivolts. Maybe even plus 10, plus 20 millivolts. Big depolarizations, large depolarizations. So LVA and HVA are the two major classes. Then we also talk about their inactivation characteristics. That was activation. Inactivation, how long do they stay on? Turns out the LVAs, there's only one type. They turn on real quickly when you start to depolarize the cell. They inactivate very quickly, rapidly inactivating. That's the good news. The bad news is there's lots of types of high voltage activated channels. Some turn on slowly, turn off slowly. Some turn on slowly, turn off quickly. Some are somewhere in between. In fact, there's one type that does not turn off at all, called non-inactivating. Anybody know what kind of recording we're looking at here? If you did your reading for today, you'd know. These are single channel recordings. You can tell that they're current recordings because of the scale again. It says amps. Single channels. Back in this particular case, you've got two channels. One step of current, total amount of current goes through one channel. Make sure you activate the other channel as well. Two steps worth of current. These are called single channel recordings, even though this is actually two channels, as opposed to this type of recording. What's that called? You're encouraged to read. And you know this is a current recording, what does that say? Amps, not volts. Are those inward or outward currents? Inward currents, because they're going downward. You should get used to looking at that kind of data. And are these inward or outward currents? One slide later, you've already completely blanked on what we just talked about. What's it say there? Amps. So that's current, right? Not volts. Okay. It says low voltage activated. But if it's a downward deflection, then current. Is that an inward or an outward current? It's an inward current. This is what a low voltage activated current looks like. It activates real close to the membrane potential, resting potential. Just a very slight depolarization will maximally activate the current. It also inactivates very rapidly, turns back off very quickly. This is what we call a high voltage activated current. And another way of looking at these currents is through what we call current voltage curves. Current voltage, or the typical abbreviation, is an IV curve. How many of y'all like bonus points on exams? Pay attention to this. It's a big hint. Current voltage relationships. On the x-axis, you've got voltage. Zero somewhere in the middle. Hyperpolarized, depolarized. Current on another axis. From no current to a large amount of current. Again, it should tell you that that's amps, not volts. It should tell you that it's volts. If these are voltage dependent, at the resting potential, these are essentially closed. As you depolarize, a low voltage current is going to come on much sooner. By the time you get to 0 millivolts, it's at maximum. Even at just a 5 or 10 millivolts of depolarization, you've got maybe 2 or 3 picoamps of current. To get to 2 or 3 picoamps of current for a high voltage activated channel, you gotta get the membrane potential up to something like plus 10. That's a high voltage activated channel. So the general shape of this is it's over in this end of the IV curve. High voltage activated, it's way over to the right. You might say high voltage activated IV curve is right shifted. If that helps you remember it. This applies to inward currents. If those were outward currents, what would those IV curves look like? They'd be going upwards instead of downwards. What kind of outward currents do neurons have? Potassium ions, potassium channels.
Had a high voltage activated potassium
effect, it would be
a mirror image of this one. A low voltage activated one,
it
would be a mirror image of this one.
I guarantee 90% of you will forget all of this by the time we take the next exam. Please don't. Please make me wrong. If you do your readings in Hammond, you'll see this over and over and over again. Neuroscientists pay a lot of attention to IV curves. They tell us very important things about ion channels. For some reason, students seem to pay relatively little attention to them. It would be to your benefit to be one of the students that does pay attention to them. Is that enough hint? How many of you know the alphabet? 6 people? I hope 100% of you do. Maybe everybody else is too busy scribbling. If you know the alphabet, it can help you know the different types of calcium channels. Apparently, the people studying calcium channels didn't know the alphabet very well. The first type of calcium channel that was discovered, they gave it the name L. You would think L would stand for something like low voltage activated, right? No, it's a high voltage activated channel. Maybe they did it to confuse you on your next exam. Maybe they had a very perverse sense of humor. L-type channels were first discovered actually in muscle cells, and then real quickly afterwards in neurons. They're very similar in structure. Molecular biologists give them this name, CAV1s. CA tells you it's a calcium channel, V tells you it's voltage dependent, the 1 tells you the class, the L-type. These are high voltage activated channels, and they're odd because they're non-inactivated. We look at the current through them. This is from a paper I published actually almost 20 years ago now. When we activate these channels, the current comes on. When we depolarize the cell, it stays on the whole time you depolarize it. It does not inactivate. You turn the current off, you repolarize the membrane, and it stops. We know a lot about the pharmacology. We can block it in various ways. We'll talk about blockers in a minute. Every time you do this, it does the same thing. High voltage activated, it takes a strong depolarization. Non-inactivated. Those are L-type channels. They're very common in neurons. The next kind of calcium channel was discovered. If you were going through the alphabet, what would be the next letter? L, M. M was already used. That was for a kind of acetylcholine receptor. And you would have thought they'd gone to N next, right? No, they chose T. T actually has some use to help you remember it. That is the transient calcium channel. T-type channels, transient. They are the only type that's low voltage activated, and they're very quickly inactivated, fast inactivated. It's only one type of low voltage activated calcium channel. Did you say we're the second one discovered? Molecular biologists, we call them CAV2s, right? Molecular biologists don't know anything about the history of neuroscience. They got to them third, so they're called CAV3s. The next type that was discovered, if you go through the alphabet, well, I guess it would be Z probably if you were going in the sequence. Now, they realized they left out M, but they went to N. N-type calcium channels, remember this is what L-type currents look like. This is what T-type currents look like. This is what N-type currents look like. If N had any mnemonic value, it would be non-inactivated. Does that look like it doesn't inactivate? No. It slowly inactivates. Remember, all of them except for the T are high voltage activated. So N is also a high voltage activated. Slowly inactivated. Then a group thought they were going to get the Nobel Prize because they discovered the kind of calcium channel that was found in axon terminals. And they named it the P-type channel. P for presynaptic. Published a whole bunch of Science and Nature papers. Were convinced they had the Nobel Prize in hand. Then another group published a bunch of Science and Nature papers. It was also postsynaptic. First group said, that's okay. P could stand for pre or post. They didn't get the Nobel Prize, though. Turns out there's another one that other groups have discovered called the Q-type. It has identical currents, but the protein is different. So P's and Q's are also high voltage activated,
slowly inactivated. And then more recently, R-type channels. Notice they left out the O here. I think overstock.com had that one already. R-type channels. Not as much current. So again, they're high voltage activated, slowly inactivated. Do I make this simple? One type of high voltage activated, non-inactivated, that's the L. One type of low voltage activated, fast inactivating, that's the transient, or T's. All the rest are high voltage activated, slow inactivated. That's it for today.